over 90 million acres of longleaf pine habitat once covered the American Southeast. Estimates vary, but over 95% of it has been destroyed. We can explore the different variants of this ecosystem on public lands, but even on private property, you might see hints of a landscape long since cut or neglected. Our story today starts with Helen Roth seeing those signs and starting a process to restore her land. She has since recruited a few partners to buy and restore the land around her. Not only are they bringing back longleaf, wiregrass, and fire to Sand Hills and Gadsden County, they are protecting a rare, diverse habitat downslope of the Sand Hills. Today, we welcome the Crooked Creek Conservation Coalition. This is Coast to Canopy, an ecology podcast from WFSU Public Media. I'm Rob Diaz de Villegas. The video version of this episode has quite a lot of imagery. You can watch that on the WFSU Ecology YouTube channel or at wfsu.org/ecologyblog. All right, joining me in the studio are three members of the Crooked Creek Conservation Coalition. Welcome to Coast to Canopy, Annie Schmidt.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning. Also joining us, Helen Roth. Good morning, Helen.
Good morning, Rob.
And joining us for the second time on Coast to Canopy, we have Gene Huffman, a dendrochronologist with Tall Timbers Research Station. Welcome back, Gene.
Thanks, Rob.
I want to start with you, Helen. So you're not a biologist by training. You're not a forester. You don't have a background in this. Mm-hmm. So tell us how you ended up restoring this property.
I was lucky. I had the great fortune of being able to purchase this 100-acre tract of land from my father, who received it from my brother's estate. And that was back in 2008 when I purchased it. And I really knew nothing about how to manage it. I just knew it had really pretty flowers, did not know the name of them, did not know what I needed to do. So I started reading books and taking classes. And one of the classes I took through Master Naturalist Program was on Sheephead Ravines out at the Nature Conservancy property. And the field trip leader was Billy Booth. It turned out he had property downstream from my property. And he told me, you need to go join the Florida Native Plant Society, Magnolia Chapter. And the meeting was the next night, so I went. And that just changed my world. I met so many people who were so generous with their time and knowledge to help me learn what I needed to know. And it is through that organization that I met Annie, and I met Gene, and I met Scott Copeland and Susan Carr, who are all part of this coalition. But we've had a lot of experiences along the way.
Yeah.
It's a learning process.
So I'm guessing for the Florida Native Plant Society members, knowing that you had this habitat on the edge of a Sheephead Ravine, talk about biologically. I mean, this is a very biodiverse kind of a habitat. So I'm guessing people got kind of excited to hear about this and wanting to check this out. Describe that as far as the diversity of plants that you find in this habitat.
Exactly. Of course, I didn't know what it was. I gradually learned that. But it is Sheephead Ravines on the east side of the Apalachicola River, the same type of ecosystem that Nature Conservancy and Torrey State Park has. It's up in the beginning headwaters. So Annie has the actual headwaters of Crooked Creek, and then it flows through my property, which used to have a dam and a pond, and then it flowed on down to where Billy and Susan have some additional property, and then to Flat Creek and out Apalachicola River and down to the Gulf, where it's providing fresh water
right.
to help our ecosystem there. So just learning all of these things about it, I didn't even realize. I knew that it had longleaf pine, but it was very difficult to see most of it because it had gone through a long period of fire exclusion. And the laurel oaks had moved in and just blocked the view of the canopy. I could see the bark. I could see from the edge some of the canopy. But there was only one place, and I call it my reference area, which was clear and had been frequently burned by my brother as a hunt plot, but it had healthy wiregrass, and I could see the full height of the longleaf pine. It was only about an acre, maybe 2 acres large.
Right.
And I just looked at that and said, I want more of the property to look like that.
So you're talking about the upland outside of the ravine, just to distinguish for our listeners.
Outside of the ravine.
Right.
It just, all the pretty flowers I initially saw were down in the ravines, you know, the mountain laurel and the Florida anise and the orange flame azalea and, you know, the pink ones also. And those were the flowers I held in my hand going, what are these? And I've later learned what they are. And a lot of them are endangered. The Pyramid Magnolia was one of the early trees I identified based on, you know, leaves I found on the ground. And when I read that it was endangered, the light bulb went off. If I have one endangered plant, I must have more. And I can't protect them if I can't identify them. So now I've got to go learn all the plants.
Right.
And that's, again, where it came in handy to be part of the Florida Native Plant Society. Dr. Lauren Anderson, who has passed now, but he was professor emeritus, was so generous with this time and coming out and helping me develop my plant list. And when anybody would identify a tree or whatever, I put a little aluminum tag on it so I could refer back to it later in a different season to see, you know, how does that compare to this other plant that I found? And there are so many other people who just have been wonderful helping me find the historical maps of the property so I could start to learn the history of it. And then Jean did a great slice of a tree stump that she was able to age to slice and polish up, and she could see all these fire rings on it. And it's 300 years old. We're still working to identify exactly what year it died to be able to date those rings. But it's just cool to have this huge slice. And then another friend, Nicole Zampieri, came out, and she did cores in the living trees that were still alive of all the longleaf pines that looked old, had flat tops. And of the 10 trees that she did, I have 2 trees that are side by side. One is the oldest and the other one's the youngest, but they don't match up in size. The oldest is the smallest and the smallest is the oldest, and it's 200 years old. So it's just cool to know. I knew I had a lot of cat-faced trees that were still alive.
Cat-faced trees. So let's explain a cat-faced tree, because that's a very common thing throughout our area.
Yes,
it's a big part of the history of this area. So what's a cat-faced tree?
It's from the turpentine industry, and that's where they did the cuts to gather the rosin, and it would drain. And then after they quit doing it, the tree would heal over, so it doesn't look as much like a cat face anymore. But they're there. They are scars, and it is a vulnerability for the tree. It affects the way that when and how I burn and what I do afterwards, because a lot of them, with combination of the fire exclusion, have a lot of duff around the base of the trees. Mm-hmm. And so I have to time my burning right after heavy rain, and then after the burn, go around and look for smoldering, because I don't want the tree to dry because of smoldering duff. So they're special. They're not going to last forever. They're gradually dying, and they remain as snags, and I appreciate them, the new life they take on as snags, but I want to keep them as long as I can because they're my kids.
Well, snags. A dead tree is as valuable as a living tree for habitat in the forest, of course.
It is.
So, you know, a steephead ravine has a hardwood forest, which is a little more densely packed with trees. When you first bought your property, maybe it was pretty densely packed with trees up in the upland too, but what is a longleaf pine forest supposed to look like?
Well, exactly. To be a sustainable longleaf pine forest, it needs light to hit the ground, an open canopy. And it needs a seed source, the mature trees. And it needs some bare ground, so a recent burn. So then when the seeds hit, they can germinate and you get natural regeneration. So I do have a lot of natural regeneration that's happening in some parts of the property, not others. When my brother had owned the property around 2003, he did a hardwood harvest where he removed those encroaching hardwoods and sold it for a profit. There was a market at that point in time. And that jump-started the natural regeneration process for that area. But he didn't follow up with burning that section. So the wiregrass looked really scraggly. That was in the southeast section. The southwest section, he didn't do any harvesting. But he did do a small prescribed burn in that area, so the wiregrass was looking good in the upper part of it.
So the fire helps the wiregrass, and it also kills back the hardwoods?
Yep, but it didn't kill back all the hardwoods. But it left some of the fire-adapted oaks, which were removed in the southeast section when he did the hardwood harvest. But he wasn't doing any herbicide at that point in time, so the small ones are still there, and I'm getting some decent ones back. And then the northeast section was sort of a combination of a little bit of clearing, a lot of encroachment. So these were all factors when I first started doing my restoration efforts.
Yeah.
So I hired a forester to do the first burn in 2010. I wasn't ready to become a prescribed burn manager. But by 2014, I was ready to do that. I did the class. So I had help from Annie and another friend, Guy Anglin and Jean, who helped me with the planning of that certified burn process because we had to do 3 burns each of those sections.
Right.
And that was a major accomplishment. And prior to that, I had started doing a little bit of hardwood cutting to prepare for that burn. So that was in 2013. So my friend Scott Copeland, who is also part of the coalition now, was helping me then. He was my first major volunteer to help me with cutting the hardwoods.
And you cut those because firewood keep it down if it was happening on a regular basis. But talk about,
exactly.
Yeah, those wood, hardwoods
it's
get kind of big.
Getting back to that, building the open canopy.
Yeah.
So a forester was able to show me on the first visit I had in 2009. He had worked with my brother, and we went to the southeast section, and he showed me all the natural regeneration that was happening because of that open canopy and light on the ground and the seed being able to find the bare ground. So, okay, this is what it takes for that to happen. But as we went into other areas that I hadn't opened up the canopy, there was no process of natural regeneration.
Right.
Just occasionally on the edge you might find a natural regen, but not much. So it wasn't really a sustainable forest. And that's what motivated me to do all of my restoration work. And that wasn't without help. There are federal and state and other organizations that help. So I worked with FWC and NRCS to do a cost share program. And I did 2 of those programs working with Arlo. First one started in 2013, ending 2016. Then I did another one. And now I'm working on the conservation stewardship program because I've done enough of the restoration. I'm eligible for it. But it's just been amazing to watch the gradual process of getting it restored. So my process of restoration has been one of removal.
Right.
And it's only going into the newest restoration areas where there's not enough ground cover that I'm having to collect seed from the restored areas and then planting it into the restoration area. And that's coming along very well, very successful. But I've talked too long. Gives you a feel for what I was doing.
Right. And so your restoration process is different than those of your partners because you had an established longleaf stand, but it was fire excluded, so hardwoods had grown to a... So Annie, talk about your property. So you have quite the opposite. So what was, when you purchased your property, what was it like? How was it managed?
It was sand pine plantation. So they were cut, and thanks to Helen, I knew Helen.
So Sand Hill Plantation, sand pine. So people can confuse that because it's a sand pine on a sand hill, and it sounds like it belongs there, but talk about... So what is a sand pine plantation? Like, why was that there?
For pulp, paper, chips for fuel, and they are sand pine, and we do have native sand pine in the scrubs, but this is a different species, not quite the native one.
Right.
All through St. Joe Paper Company, Holland, where they planted sand pine throughout. And it turns out that they had cleared the first initial area abutting Helen's property. And it was Helen and her husband that said, oh, you guys ought to buy this. And we bought it. It was about 154 acres. I think we bought it after it was cleared.
Okay.
And then so it was absolutely nothing. And I had done a lot of work as a conservation biologist on this project, a multi-state sandhill ecological restoration project. And it was for veg, monitoring the veg pre and post and monitoring the birds. And it was amazing. We bought it in 2016 in October. And after they had cut it, once the ground cover got light, all these species, on-site species that belong in sand hill habitat type, were coming up. It was incredible. And that fall, we planted the seed, the wiregrass seed mix, and the pine trees, and burning, and we were off to the races. But we started from nothing.
Right.
And looked at Helen's property and said, someday we'll be like that. And that's the cool story about all of our properties. We started at just different stages of the restoration.
Yeah.
So it's a really cool story, you know.
Yeah. And so your background is you and your husband were with the Nature Conservancy for some years. And I know I've covered how they restore sand pine, and, you know, I guess that the term they used was moonscaping, right? And
so right. Oh,
you remove everything, and then talk about that process. So, you know, even without planting any seeds, plants came up?
Oh, yes. We modeled the restoration. I didn't work for DNC. I was the wife of the gardener.
Right, okay.
I did a couple, you know, little projects with them. And we didn't moonscape as much because we saw, after it was cleared, when we bought the property, a lot of these things were already coming up. So we just burned where we could in our attempt at a moonscape and went from there. Whereas the other piece I have, it was after Hurricane Michael when we started the restoration, so clearing up the fallen sand pine, we had no choice but to moonscape. So even two pieces of my properties, they're different. Yeah, that's what TNC, they would moonscape. And the on-site species still came. It's outrageous. Just give me light. And
some rare plants come up too. I mean, I remember visiting a spot, maybe it was 1 or 2 years into after they had cleared it, and there were, you know, Apalachicola rosemary and Florida calamint and a lot of really cool wildflowers all over the place there. So, Jean, you know, your background, when I first met you, you were managing the St. Joseph Bay State Buffer Preserve, and the story we did was on you were maintaining it with fire, and that's a different type of environment than a sandhill. Talk about that a little bit and sort of moving from that to a sandhill.
Right. My background is both fire ecology, kind of academic, and management, but I started out at Myakka River State Park as a biologist, and that's flatwoods. And then I went to St. Joseph Bay State Buffer Preserve and managed that. which is also flatwoods. So my whole background in land management was in flatwoods until I came to this project. And this is sandhill, very different thing. Flatwoods is palmetto and a really different ground cover.
And it's it was a lot wetter, too, at the buffer, too. You called it like a wet prairie or a...
Well, they're wet mesic flatwoods, wet flatwoods. And wet prairie. And yeah, it's a big difference between the flatwoods and the sandhill is that the flatwoods generally have really high water table and or even standing water part of the year, where sandhill is really well drained and doesn't have that kind of standing water situation and very different plant species, no palmetto, very different with burning.
Yeah. So how did you become involved? And you're not a landowner along this area, but you're helping someone out. So talk about how you became involved.
Right. I'm involved because my friend Susan Carr bought into this situation. First, she bought a 12-acre piece that's adjacent to Helen's. That's the same. It's adjacent to Helen's and Annie's. And it's the same kind of habitat like Helen's. It was fire-excluded sandhill. And then when more of the ex-sand pine land became available, she bought 288 acres of that. And so she bought this land for conservation, but she lives in Gainesville and she has a job and she wasn't able to manage it. And I had moved from land management to doing the tree ring studies more, and I kind of miss land management. I'm a prescribed burner since, a certified Florida prescribed fire manager since 1989, and I wanted to keep in land management because I find it really fulfilling to see the, you know, concrete results of your actions. And so Susan enlisted me to manage her land and you know, get the restoration process going.
Susan Carr couldn't make it to Tallahassee on the day we recorded, so we caught up with her later.
I remember when the Nature Conservancy, the Nature Conservancy first bought the Apalachicola Bluffs and Ravines property, and I was working for the Florida Natural Areas Inventory at the time for the state. And we went out there and did some controlled burns when they first, and that was in the late 80s, that was a long time ago. Right. And so I was kind of, feel like I was there at the beginning as a volunteer. And then moved away and everything. Well, I wound up getting a PhD in plant ecology where I studied sandhill vegetation. And actually, Apalachicola Bluffs and Ravines, again, was one of the places that I visited and sampled vegetation there. So I had, as a researcher, I had some exposure there. And then part three, buying some land near there. So I guess the Apalachicola Bluffs and Ravines is probably the nexus of all this.
Right.
Yeah.
So as a plant biologist, I mean, I guess when you have the opportunity to buy land, with a steephead ravine and a sandhill, I mean, talk about that. I mean, was that kind of exciting to you?
I think that's what got us interested. I mean, well, Helen being there and owning the land, the original 100, and then Annie and Jack coming in and buying that land. And I think that what they really loved was the steephead ravines at the headwaters of Crooked Creek, and of course the waterfall, which I think you went to see. So that was a big draw. And all these lands had been owned by St. Joe Timber Company. And so the uplands were all sand pine, like dense sand pine plantations. So they were getting cleared. So we were buying lands that were like blank slates. You know, they were literally just slicked off pretty much nothing on the ground.
Right.
So talk about a blank canvas for restoration. So yes, I think the steepheads and everything kind of appealed to us initially. And then we got way more involved in the upland restoration.
With the sandhill, everyone, I guess, in this group has a different kind of a slightly different story about, you know, what condition their land was in and what they had to do to restore it. You know, Helen had, you know, she was just fire suppressed, so she just had to do some clearing, and Annie had to clear everything out. And that sounds sort of what your story is on your land as well. But then you also have a different part of your property too that has like another type of pine plantation on there.
Yes, you're right. We've got every type of starting condition all the way. We call Helen's is our desired future condition.
Right.
That's some kind of jargon, and you know that she her place was never cut over or soil disturbed. You know, it wasn't chopped or bedded or disced or anything like that. Right. And then we have everything beyond that. So on my property, yes, I have stuff that was in sandpine plantation then cut over. I have areas that were bedded, so soil disturbance. And I have places that were just fire suppressed but were not soil disturbed. And I keep buying more land. So now I bought this other 80 acres that actually has really nice second growth longleaf pine on it, but just really fire suppressed. So now we're in the that's a whole different bag of worms when it comes to restoration. So yeah, we've got it all.
And that's all planted in rows, and it's planted pretty thickly too, isn't it?
Yeah, this one piece that was planted by the previous landowner before I bought it, and it's about 40 acres. And they had planted it in preparation for pine straw harvesting.
Okay.
So for that, it's longleaf in rows, but it's pretty dense.
Do you mind talking about pine straw harvesting? That's something that came up after we did the initial recording, and then Jean sent me a little email about it, and then we saw some of it around there. So talk about a pine straw plantation. What does that look like, and how do they manage it?
So pine straw, the product, and I think I saw some out in front of this building, is longleaf pine needles are long and really good mulch, right? And you see these needles, you know, in uses mulch all over the place. So they're a commercial product. And so the pine trees drop their needles and then they're raked up either by humans or machine.
Right.
Okay, so a lot had, so at the more industrial scale, they use machines to rake it up. But the thing is, they need a very clean floor. So they use a lot of herbicides to kill the ground cover. And these systems are all about the ground cover, right? It's a pretty biologically sterile environment, as you can imagine. Now, I mean, I don't mean to impugn the whole thing or whatever. There are other various forms of pine straw raking that doesn't use a lot of herbicide.
Right.
But on the industrial scale, I guess, you know, where the profits are more hefty. Yeah. And so our land is kind of surrounded by that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so we always call, you know, longleaf pine ecosystems, and that really maybe sort of undersells how important the ground cover is. Talk about that, the importance of ground cover plants in this ecosystem.
So let's start with diversity, right? Plant diversity. Well, the aspect of longleaf pine woodlands, they really are woodlands. It's very open with a lot of grasses and shrubs and stuff like that in the ground cover. So if you think about it, in the canopy, you have one species, longleaf pine. In the mid-story, there may be a few oaks or whatever, but on the ground cover, there may be hundreds of species, and this is what I studied for my PhD, so I could go on and on, but like hundreds of grasses, sedge, forbs, asters, all kinds of stuff. Well, so that's where the plant diversity is. It's also where the animal diversity is in terms of insects, things that live under the ground like gopher tortoises, pocket gophers. So many snakes live in that. So the diversity is really in the ground cover.
Yeah.
And the ground cover is maintained with these frequent cool fires that deter these things growing up into being forests.
Right.
So if you take fire out, they turn into a forest.
I want to get a clarification on what's a cool fire.
Okay. Well,
I kind of know what you mean, but for the audience, yeah.
True. Well, these little glow ground fires, it's not what you see on TV, like, you know, with a big conflagration. They're just kind of creeping along, burning the grass layer, so they may only be a couple feet high.
Yeah.
I mean, you could probably just step over it. So that's what I mean by cool. I mean, if you stuck your hand in it, it wouldn't be cool, but...
And you achieve that, I guess, also by just burning regularly, right? So you don't have a lot of fuel on the ground.
That's right. If you burn every 2-3 years, there's not a lot of dense fuel, so it's going to be pretty low.
So you have this highly diverse upland habitat, and then you have this sort of ravine habitat, which is full of just rare and endemic species. So you must have a lot of surprises all the time. talk about, Helen told us about one day you guys were walking in a ravine on your property, correct? And you found a full-sized, kind of large Torreya tree?
Yes, yes.
Talk about that.
Yeah, I know. We just were doing that this morning, too, looking for that same sapling, but did not find it. Yes, that's right. This was actually right before I closed on the land. We walked back in there, and there was one Torreya sapling. Torreya is Florida's only endangered tree, federally endangered tree, and it is only right in this area. It's a really weird thing. And it's got a terrible fungus that kills, kind of like the American chestnut story, right. Has a fungus that kills adult trees. So there are a number of seedlings and saplings still out there, but not a lot of large ones.
So a question I asked everybody, whenever I talk to anybody who's doing a longleaf restoration, that's not really a thing that one accomplishes in a lifetime. So talk about sort of just perspective of starting something that you're not going to finish necessarily.
Thanks for reminding me. Yeah.
But also to just future-proofing it. So whenever you start something and you're trying to raise trees that will become 400 years old, right. How do you ensure that happens?
Well, first I say it's more than just the tree. We're really trying to restore the entire system. And we're just out there this morning, and there's lots of beautiful native grasses, and some gopher tortoises are moving in. So there's all that. So that's, I guess, most of it. The trees themselves, well, they're popping up. And I like the seedlings and the saplings. And I can always look over at Helen's land to see what a mature forest will look like. Even I may not be around to see it. But I've got... interesting, you mentioned that you got Helen's land that you can always look at is, that's what it might look like in the future. Then you got Annie's, it's the intermediate, and then I'm the one that's, I'm the one that's just getting started, so yeah.
Yeah.
How many total acres now between all the landowners, more or less?
Just over 1,000.
Just over 1,000. And it's in this... I guess it's in the same, bioregion, I guess we would call the Apalachicola Bluffs and Ravines region. And that's, 1,000 acres of private land, which is a lot. And then Torreya State Park, the Nature Conservancy, and it's this whole really cool bioregion. So I want to talk about, the fire. Being a certified, this is something you've done professionally for throughout your career. You got certified, did you say 2014?
You
said 2014.
Yeah.
No, I'm 98.
Oh, okay, gotcha. So you've both been burning for a while.
And doing it for work.
Yeah. So talk about...
They helped me so much.
Right. Talk about coming into this, you haven't been doing this for your whole life professionally. Talk about all of a sudden at a point in your life, I'm going to learn this whole different... you're setting the forest on fire. talk about that.
Well, I did the training, a bunch of classes that I took in advance. And then you have to do two burns before doing your certification burns. So that's where I was pulling in help from my friends. And even now that I'm certified, the main advantage is that it does help provide liability coverage. If anything does go wrong and I'm doing everything, right, by the book, it just protects a little bit if it's a certified burn. So I will pull the ticket on my burns, but I'm still not comfortable being the ignition boss, really running the burn itself. I do all my work in preparing for the burn. I have good fire lanes. I do mowing and blowing of those.
Let's talk about fire lanes.
And I will do the cleanup afterwards. But for the ignition, I generally tap one of my friends who are part of the burn crew to head it up, coordinate that.
Yeah.
Because I'm running around in my UTV delivering water and fuel and tried to take a few pictures.
So you said fire lanes. So if you look at the National Forest, Tate's Hell's one that you can especially look at from a satellite map and see a grid of dirt roads.
Yes.
So talk about having fire lanes and why you do that.
Well, the fire lanes, it's not just for the fire lanes. It's a means of transportation to get around and do maintenance work in between. Those are my regular roads and sort of outline my steep head ravines and the borders of the property and the different units. So it's practical in that sense. But for the fire itself, if you just want to burn one section, then that helps control that. Now, as far as the ravines go, initially I thought I needed to have a fire lane to separate the uplands from the ravine, but I've gotten more comfortable with the idea of just letting the fire creep down into the ravine. If there's fuel to burn, it'll creep down further. If there isn't any fuel built up again, it won't creep as far. It just will go as far as it needs to go. Yeah. But it's still within the outside border of the property, and just need to make sure it doesn't climb back out.
Right. So with a ravine, I guess I've heard it explained is that any habitat will have fire at some point. It's just
sure.
that something like the longleaf, which would burn every year or two, is a lot more frequent than, say, a ravine, which would be much less frequent. And then just, yeah.
But it does build up fuel.
Yeah.
I have a great picture that Gene took of the fire going down into the ravine. It sort of outlined the seepage stream down at the bottom before actually hitting it and going out. It's a fascinating process to watch that. And then the recovery. I mean, it recovers fine, even the mountain laurel. It'll grow back again.
Yeah. And that's a mountain laurel. That's one of those things that's found in a steephead ravine, but it's also common in the Appalachians. Is that
yes.
right? There's a lot of things like that in steephead ravines.
Oh, so many.
Yeah.
That's what adds to the biodiversity. We have our coastal plain plants, plus we have the Appalachian mountain plants.
Yeah.
So I have downy serviceberry and sourwood, which are not common hardwoods around here, but I love them, the spring white flowers and the bright red fall leaves.
Yeah. So, Annie, you have the headwaters of the steephead. I don't know how comfortable you guys are talking about like this geology of a steephead ravine. So there's water coming out. It's groundwater, correct?
Right. The sand hill is made up of the ancient sand dunes when the sea levels were the highest. You guys correct me if I'm wrong.
No, you're
right. Sounds good so far, yeah.
And so the water kind of trickles down through these ancient dunes, and it hits a layer. I'm not real, knowledgeable about this stuff. So it hits a layer of clay, and in this case, it comes out from the bottom. And so that's why these steep head ravines and the steep head, it's kind of a slump that has sort of it looks like an amphitheater. The water is coming out from the bottom.
Right. It's
taking sand with it, and then the
exactly.
sand above it sloughs down.
Right. It's eroding from the bottom instead of from the top. Right?
Exactly.
That's why I've had it explained to me by Bruce Means, who's
great at
explaining it.
Yeah. He's a pro.
Yeah. And that's why it's very narrow and steep, I guess, is obviously by the name. But also, too, talk about the depth of these sandhills, because, I go myself. I love going south of Tallahassee, the Munson Sandhills, and there's some topography there.
Mm-hmm.
But when you get out by the Apalachicola River, we're talking about how deep are those sandhills, and consequently also how deep do those ravines end up being?
We have over 150-foot elevation on our land.
Yeah.
Which is up at the headwaters, and they're not as deep as closer to the river. That's much deeper and gets into richer soils. So you get plant life variation between the older ravines close to the river, that richer soils, than our xeric, dry, sandy, high and dry lands. So there are plants that are adapted to that high and dry that don't grow in the richer soils, and vice versa. We don't have some of those lower ones. So we're in a little transition area of things that Annie has, I don't have, I have, she doesn't have, Billy doesn't have, but Billy has other things I don't have, When we were exploring the new property that Susan has, just 400 feet off my property, we found a nice sized Toria tree.
Yeah.
I knew that they were at least 2 miles within our range.
Yeah.
So that was cool to find. I just have little seedlings I planted with seed that I got from botanical gardens.
So Toria trees, of course, for any listeners who don't know the Toria tree is one of the rarest trees in the world, and it's only found within a 20-mile stretch of the east side of the Apalachicola River on the slopes of bluffs and ravines. And so to have one, and especially because how big is that Torreya trees? I know they're affected by blight, correct? And
so they were. So the ones that were original, it's just resprouts coming up from the base. Mm-hmm. And then they get a certain size and they die off and send up another resprout. It's a sad story. We're still hopeful that maybe they'll come up with an antifungal treatment for them, but
and
we'll see.
But you also mentioned, I'm doing a separate story where someone got seedlings from the Atlanta Botanical Garden. And so talk about, that's sort of a little bit of an experiment, I guess, to see they're trying to breed, talk about that. They're trying to breed, I guess, a blight-resistant strain of Torreya tree.
What they did with the chestnuts is inspirational for it. So there are multiple approaches that they're taking. And Atlanta Botanical Gardens has just been wonderful to work with. And they care so much about the Torreya trees and so many other plants like the Apalachicola rosemary, et cetera. So I'll let them speak to the actual science that they're doing.
Gotcha. Did you want to talk about Apalachicola rosemary? You had a story. Yes, you told me on the phone yesterday.
I do have a story on that.
That's a plant I've covered for a long time. And
I went traipsing throughout the Torreya State Forest lands while it was still sand pine with Annie looking for the Conardina glabra population so that we could further monitor them after it was cleared and restored. And they survived very well in that situation, which is encouraging, like that extra sunlight. But just last year, 2 years ago, I was on my property and I slammed on the brake of my UTV as I was driving by. I went, oh my God, that's Conradina glabra. How'd that get there? And as part of my restoration work where I've opened up the canopy and I've cleared off vines, it got the habitat it needed. And it was a nice sized bush and flowering. And I called Annie and Annie took care of vouchering it. Okay. So it is recorded.
It's official.
But it's a very lone plant. It's only 2 miles from the main population, but it is a different county. So this was a county.
So talk about that. You guys are in Gadsden County. Uh-huh. And talk about where, I mean, it's a very localized population. Talk about that. So where is Apalachicola rosemary found or traditionally been said to have been found?
Well, Annie, Liberty I'll let you County. Talk about that.
Only.
Only Liberty County and only by Steephead Ravines, correct?
Exactly. Well, it's also in the Sand Hill, sort of in fire shadows. But yes.
It's a very highly specialized plant.
Very.
They had it at native nurseries, and I tried to grow one in my house, and I got sandy soils. I even put some bits of charcoal from the my fire pit. I'm like, oh, maybe that'll, but it just it needs something very specific to that deep sandhill green area.
It could be a fungus.
Top of the forest. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so it's exciting. It's new discoveries. You think you know everything about the property and something new comes up. Yeah. So it's what I look forward to every time I go out there. What new discoveries am I going to have today? And enjoying the peace and quiet as I'm working.
Yeah.
And
so your ravines, you're all in the same ravine?
Yes.
And so talk about sort of the drainage of that ravine. So those ravines, when they start out the Apalachicola River, and I've seen there's new ones that are still forming on Allen Bluff, and you see these little waterfalls and these tiny little ravines. And so that's where it starts, and it's gone all the way through Liberty County all the way into Gadsden County, right? So how does yours connect back to the Apalachicola River?
Well, I think I'd take it backwards.
Yeah,
it starts with us. Ending as it hits the Apalachicola River. So originally started at the Apalachicola River and grew out.
And
but
it's still
the
growing.
Water flow is from the headwaters going back down to it.
The signature is this kind of Christmas tree kind of. You'll have the main one, but then as it evolves, you get the other side ones, steep heads going in
the
sapping. I think it's called sapping erosion.
It is sapping.
And so they come from, as the main one starts in these deep sand dunes.
Yeah.
Then there'll be side ones coming in.
It's a cool pattern when you look at it on the satellite
map, because
it does look
very
like a Christmas tree with a branch, and then each branch has two branches or something like that. Don't quote me on that. But so if you were to walk, get down at your headwaters and start walking down the creek, assuming it's unobstructed the whole way, where do you end up like walking? Do you end up on like Torreya State Park, the Nature Conservancy, or somewhere else? Or
our water goes from Annie through mine, through Susan's, to Billy's, you know, it's this crooked creek, and it's flowing west and north, which is interesting that it flows north.
Yeah.
But it hits Flat Creek right before Flat Creek goes into the Apalachicola River.
Okay.
Flat and Creek. It's going by the Asplaga unit of Torrey State
okay,
Park.
Right.
So that's our vision, is to get the full corridor of Crooked Creek under conservation easement. And there are other interested people along that corridor that it may be doable, but that is our goal.
And that would be, a combination of privately owned land and public land once you get to Torreya State Park.
Get
and then
the
with
private to the public.
Yeah.
And then on up.
How many miles are you from the river? Do you know?
I'm so bad at
I'm not.
I bet we could look on Google Maps later and I could add it graphically.
I think we'd be safe, between 10 and miles.
Yeah, okay.
That's probably reasonable.
I think that'd be, I know when I drive over to Torreya, it's probably 15, 20 minutes.
Yeah,
and as you see, I drive fast.
So, Helen, I guess I first heard about what you were doing with the restoration, I guess, through a lot of friends of mine. I have a lot of friends who were in conservation, and every once in a while, there's a call for volunteers to do some planting or some work. Talk about this sort of community aspect and what kind of work are people doing and where you need like dozens of hands.
Oh, exactly. And that was part of my getting involved with the Native Plant Society. And really, it's not just going to the meetings and hearing the programs. It's a matter of getting involved with the volunteer work. That's where you make the relationship with the people and you see the difference that you can make in the environment. So we've have projects going on with Ancus Goolson Nature Park. We have them going on with Wolf Creek Trout Lily Preserve. My friend Scott Copeland, who's part of our coalition and has worked with me so long in clearing my land, he would take sparkleberry trees that we cut down to open up the habitat, and he'd repurpose them by making walking sticks out of them.
Okay.
And then he'd take them to Wolf Creek, and they'd set them up in a display where people could do a donation and get a walking stick. So it's serving another purpose, and it's just real cool. He'd put out freebies at a lot of the different hiking stations. So another place we do work is McClay Gardens. We have a native plant arboretum. And Bob Farley has a wildflower garden down in Blinston. So we're scattered, and we do a lot of booths, and, education opportunities abounds. So I learned so much when I was first volunteering with Annie and doing all those vegetation surveys. Well, doing that with her in the TNC and Torreya State Park lands, that was the big guys. I'm just a mini-me of that environment. But what I learned doing that helped me understand my property.
Yeah.
So the relationships with all my best friends now are affiliated with the Native Plant Society now. It's part of my essence at this point.
Yeah. And so what kind of things do they do when they come to your property? I've seen people, I guess, planting longleaf pine or wiregrass.
Well, yeah. Mostly, I have a lot of field trips with different organizations coming, and that's generally spring flowers or the fall flowers up in the uplands, and the spring is in the ravines. But I have different people who come to help me with my brush management, get ready for prescribed burns, opening up the canopy. We had a big event with the pond that was on the property. Hurricane Sally damaged the dam the backside of it. So U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service stepped in and agreed to remove it and did a beautiful job. And that was an offer I couldn't pass up. So in addition to restoring my uplands, now I'm restoring the stream bed. So salamanders and little darter fish can go from the creek below the dam all the way up to Annie's channel. So it's free passage now. And it was just fascinating to watch the process that they're going down and removing the dirt. As they removed the dirt to put it back where it originally came from, they learned that when they first took that dirt and made the dam, they put the upper sand on the bottom and then the clay on top, which is backwards from how it should have been, probably contributed to the failure. But then as they put it back, it was just piles of red dirt, white dirt, orange dirt. You know? And so when a soil scientist hates reference to dirt, but truly, that restored ridge is not restored because it is piles of dirt that were spread together. So it's going to take a little while with ants working and everything else to really recreate that AB, you know, horizon of true soil. But that was fascinating watching that process. And then the stream itself, they just let it create its own channels naturally, except for where the dam was. And then they cut a curvy channel in there. Hmm. And they brought in some, they saved some of the vegetation from the dam to put along that edge. And they came back and planted some water-loving plants on that short stretch, river oak and cypress trees and sycamore trees. Hmm. And then they gave me a lot of longleaf pines that I could plant on the drier slopes leading down to the creek. So I did that. And so they're beginning to get a pretty good height. It's sort of exciting watching the comeback of the plants. Juncus sort of took over all of it, and now it's dying back again where you have a cleared discrimination of the upland ridges with grasses and then the wetland bogs. There's some seepage bogs along one of the edge that just stay all wet all the time, and lots of yellow-eyed grass and sphagnum moss and club moss showing up. So those are good wetland indicators. It's a constant wet area slope. I can still walk on it, but it's going to be an interesting one to watch and see how it fully evolves.
So, question for all of you, and anyone can answer, because a lot of this restoration's happened within the last 20 years. Mm-hmm. And if you're planting new longleaf pine trees, how long does it take for a longleaf pine to kind of look like a tree?
Well, that one on the steep head, 2 years ago, or three, it was just removed in 2022.
Yeah.
So some of those are really as tall as I am. And I look at Annie's, you planted yours in 2017.
Yeah, around the barn, the first tract, 2017.
Yeah.
And they're as tall as you. Okay. Some are a little taller.
Yeah.
And even some this past year, have you guys noticed? They are having their own pine cones. Okay. They're having babies. My babies are having babies.
Gotcha. So, but they stay for a while, like in, I guess, the grass stage.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
And so for a long time, they look, if you don't know the difference too well, they kind of look like the wire grass, a little bit
exactly.
Around.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Exactly.
That's a learning curve. I love to point that out to people because I was shocked when I first learned that.
Why aren't you growing? Takes a few years. And then, so they're 6 feet tall-ish if they're my height, but they're still making pine cones at that height?
Yes, a few, not
a few,
all
yeah,
of them.
Yeah, yeah, interesting.
But one thing that's really amazing, I had some new pine tublings that were planted last January around the barn, thanks to Tall Timbers. They said I needed a few more pines. And this drought we've had was absolutely horrid, but it It's unbelievable. Most of those planted in January, they're still like a little grass stage. They survived. Huh. So they had already been starting to get that deep, deep, deep taproot, right, which they developed for several years to grow. And it already in a year, it must have gotten deep enough to hang in there this past year. But that they do. They go take a long time to get to that deep, deep taproot, and then they'll bolt up.
Well, a lot of the sandhill adapted plants do have these deep roots because sand doesn't hold water, right?
So exactly.
Yeah.
They've got to adapt.
Yeah.
We had a friend, it was a native plant society end of the year party at my barn, and we had a visiting a great botanist, and he was collecting some things. And he, right outside, there's something called, it's Euphorbia floridana. It's endemic to the sandhills, to the area, the region. And he wanted to take it to bring it to the herbarium, collect it. He dug. And this plant is just a herbaceous plant. And he didn't even get the whole root. The root was higher than this ceiling.
Right. And then for people listening at home, you know, Annie's fingers were maybe 3 inches apart when she was indicating the height. Yeah, I know we're shooting video too, but yeah, just for the radio audience, yeah. You get 3-inch above ground plant, and then you said the roots were,
yeah.
As tall as the ceiling, at least.
And he didn't get it all.
Yeah.
I mean, it's so cool, the adaptations, these sandhill species have that hang in there.
So I want to shift a little bit from plants to animals. As you were talking, you know, as you restore this, you start, you know, obviously the plants come in and you get a lot of really cool flowers, a lot of really rare flowers or flowers that are only found in this habitat or in this region. But then as you start restoring the habitat, what else do you see start coming in as far as animals?
Yeah, there are lots of animals within the butterflies. Brown elfin. Spring Canyon is one of the best places to find that because I have so much mountain laurel, and it uses that as a host plant.
Okay.
So they're tied together. And the king hairstreak that they're monitoring likes the horse sugar. So I try to be sure I protect some of that. And even if it burns, it does resprout nicely.
Right.
So, you know, that's good. So that's insects. On the animals, for the longest time, I just kept looking for fox squirrels. And they've run away. You just barely see them. But I do have one now that's pretty tame.
I do.
This past year.
Really?
So they're checking me out. And it doesn't care. It sits there eating, just looking at me. You know, it doesn't run away anymore. But I caught a lot of those on game cam. I caught a gray fox with the game cam.
Wow.
So I worked with Carolina Abruzzi at NFREC for doing a conservation game cam recording. So
gotcha.
It takes time to go through all the pictures that you might get if the wind blows the grasses, you know, to find the pictures of the animals. But I have posted them to iNaturalist, and so they're there.
And
so,
birds.
Yes.
Either. Yeah. Of course, the gopher tortoise is an indicator of good ground cover. So a lot of the effort that we do out there is to take this degraded habitat and get back the ground cover, which is where the diversity of plants are and everything, and kind of a indicator of success is gopher tortoises. And
the biggest success is to get those baby gopher tortoises. And I've
and
seen
I have
them
a bunch.
Live.
Really?
So I have game cam pictures, but I love when I find them live. And just watch them running back to their home.
And then the ground cover restoration area. So Helen has, you know, gopher tortoises that kind of made it through the fire exclusion and the hardwoods smothering out the ground cover. Now she brings the ground cover back and the gopher tortoises are doing well. And it's the same thing with Annie and Susan's land where you actually do ground cover restoration. And now the gopher tortoises are coming back and expanding.
Mm-hmm. And part of that is that they're eating the ground cover, but also they need space for their burrows too, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so if you are successful in buying all the property, you know, or getting people to buy property and connecting, being kind of contiguous with Terea mm-hmm. State Park. Now, Terea State Park is in the process of restoring the Sweetwater Tract with the Nature Conservancy. And part of that, I guess, you know, we're talking maybe decades, hundreds of years, maybe, I don't know. They're releasing all those indigo snakes and they need the gopher tortoises, you know, for the winter and to breed. And so eventually, I mean, you know, long term, you know, indigo snakes could be using those gopher tortoise burrows on your property.
We're hoping they make their way. And yes, maybe one day they'll bring us some recuncated woodpeckers, you know. We'll see. But we are getting on our own bobwhite quail and Bachman sparrow.
Birds. Yes.
So we're working with Tall Timbers and Cornell and Appalachian Audubon to do a Burning for Birds program. So they come out and they do a survey of the birds prior to a growing season burn and then after the growing season burn. And this is just to gather the data to reassure landowners that it's okay to burn during the growing season. We can keep the birds. In fact, they're thriving. You know, the populations are increasing. So that's fun research to participate in.
And it's Annie knows this better than anybody, but the birds that are decreasing are grassland birds. And restoring the basically grasslands out there, especially mm-hmm. like at Annie's, and the birds that you have, the grassland birds are declining all other places, are increasing tremendously on this property because of the restoration. And that includes the birds, like when we were burning Annie's land recently, there's the kites that are attracted to birds.
Mississippi kites.
Swallowtail kites. Yeah. But also, of course, the bobwhite quail, that's the one that really is the firebird, you know, that increasing. And Annie can say about other species.
Yeah, the Bachman sparrow was mm-hmm. really dropping out. Yeah. But
you have it, right?
We didn't have Bob. I've done bird work for years, and it was interesting that we didn't have, and I did bird surveys at ABRP, and when Jack and I bought this property, we'd be out there, and I'm going, why don't we have any Bob White? After several years of the restoration, all of a sudden, I started hearing Bob White, and I go, Ellen, we're getting Bob White out there.
Yeah.
So you build it, it comes. We had some Bachman sparrows, but with, as Jean is saying, with us building it and also we're expanding, you know, the diversity, that's the other cool thing about our different stages of the restorations and, you know, different ages. We're getting... They're coming. You get goosebumps every spring.
Yeah.
You know, more and more of those voices. It's so bird voicing.
Yeah. Yeah. Little woodcocks.
Yeah. Oh, yes. And American woodcocks were coming in the winter. They may be, I heard one, but usually about this time of year, which is kind of unusual. So, and those you hear sort of before first light, and then after last light.
Nighthawks.
Nighthawks like crazy.
Yeah.
It's just we're getting more and more. Which other ones am I forgetting, you guys?
Yeah. I don't know.
Know the birds better than me. I focus on building habitat.
We have brown-headed nuthatches.
Oh, yes.
We're getting more and more.
I don't know if you guys use the Merlin bird app. It seems like I do it in my yard, and my yard has, you know, mockingbirds and cardinals and things like that. I'm sure doing it in your yards might be a lot more fun.
Yeah. Ground doves are good.
Yeah, yeah. And then, of course, the goal would be, and I guess you would need more mature trees for it, would be the red cockaded woodpecker.
Yeah. We have all the other woodpeckers.
Yeah.
That's the one we're missing. So I've really enjoyed seeing the red-headed woodpeckers move in. And that's because of all the snags.
Right.
Because part of opening up the canopy while I cut the smaller trees, I just girdled the really large laurel oaks and left them as snags. and the woodpeckers are taking advantage of that. And I've lost some longleaf pines also, so those snags are there as well. So, you know, it's nice to see that second life.
Yeah, yeah. I guess I have one final question. So I've talked to people who have started longleaf pine restorations, and so it's not a thing that is accomplished in a single lifetime. So really, I guess, I mean, as far as the ultimate goal of, you know, multi-generational, you know, trees and getting it to be an old growth again, if that can happen. But talk about that. So how do you future-proof the work you're doing?
Yeah. Conservation easement through tall timbers. It's just mentally, that was just such a relief for me. I know the property's not going to be clear cut or subdivided, or, you know, there's a resource to help them through the process of new ownership, whoever owns it next. There are annual reviews that they do, and that's an opportunity to guide and support the new owner to maintain it in a manner that's appropriate, you know, is sustainable. So I'm just so thankful that Tall Timbers was willing to take us on for easement and all the support that they have been providing. It's just been
phenomenal.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely. And as Helen says, I'm sorry to interrupt, the peace of mind. You go out there and you just... it's in perpetuity. And so all the migrating birds or the butterflies, you feel so good they're going to come back and it won't be paved.
Right.
It's mm-hmm. It's really great. And Tall Timbers is absolutely phenomenal.
They have so many separate departments that help in different ways with their fire science and the birding and the land conservation and, yeah, multiple sources of support.
Yeah.
Great. Well, thank you guys so much for this. Has been a really fun conversation. Annie Schmidt, Helen Roth, Gene Huffman, thanks for being on Coast to Canopy.
You're welcome. Thank you for having us.
The sound you're hearing is a waterfall at the headwaters of Crooked Creek on Annie's property. If you're watching the video version, you're seeing it too. For our listeners, you might want to check out the video version. I spent a day touring the properties, and Helen shared a wealth of photos. You can see that on the WFSU Ecology YouTube channel or at wfsu.org/ecologyblog. The blog also has a few photos we didn't see in the video of rare plants, snakes, and other sites of sand hills and steephead ravines on these privately owned lands. I also have too many stories to count about these habitats and the flora and fauna in them. Again, you can find them all at wfsu.org/ecologyblog. I can't explore the Apalachicola River and its steephead ravines and tupelo swamps, or the different varieties of fire-dependent longleaf pine ecosystems, without viewers and listeners like you. WFSU is both an NPR and PBS station, and we can't serve our community without your support. Any amount helps, but for a $10 a month pledge, I'll give you a shout out on this podcast, like right now. Thank you to David Blair, Carol Goodyear, Veronica Humphrey, Lisa Johnson, Chris McFarland, Carrie Maddox, Clara Mullins, Alina Pryor, Dylan Riles Hamilton, Kim Sash, Donna Tharp, and, starting right after we recorded this episode, Thomas and Helen Roth. You can join the Seed Circle at wfsu.org/ecologyblog. This has been Coast to Canopy, an ecology podcast from WFSU Public Media. Today we had Taylor Cox running audio, Justin Edwards on the RoboCams, and Jason Acuna directing video. And I am your host and producer of all things ecology at WFSU, Rob Diaz de Villegas.